It's Charles Barkley here with Wayfair. And let me tell you, game day is serious business at my house. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grill accessories, Wayfair's got it all. And it shows up fast. I'm talking fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game. And head to Wayfair.com to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
At Lowe's, we're about to kick off something epic for fans who want more messy. And trust us, you'll want to be a rewards member when it happens. Join for free and get access to messy exclusives, surprises, and more. Head to Lowe's.com/more messy. Now's the time to get in, because members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Finding the right furniture for my home can be hard, especially when I'm looking for trendy, high-quality pieces that won't break the bank. Luckily, at Bob's Discount Furniture, I can shop the latest styles and customer favorites with tons of five-star reviews, like Bob's Real Marble Elm Dining Set, which has over 600 five-star reviews. The Copper Radiance mattress, which over 400 Bob's customers say will give you five-star sleep. The ultra-comfy Phantom reclining sofa, which boasts over 1,000 five-star reviews. And the customizable modular Bob's sectional, which not only costs just $250 per piece, but has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So when you're ready to score five-star style for every room in your home at everyday low prices, listen to the smartest shoppers around and stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture. Where America shops for furniture.
We're joined in this portion of our program by Josh Douglas. Joshua Douglas is a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law. He is joining us on our program to share some information that is part of his new book, Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Now, that is an interesting idea and an interesting topic for a book. First of all, it's nice to have you join us on our program.
Thank you for having me.
So many areas to go in discussion, but one of the key ones that I think is a great thing to get us started, and we'll talk about the book as well in the course of this discussion, is talking about the actual number of eligible voters who are participating in this great process of elections. What percent of eligible voters actually voted in the last presidential election?
So in 2016, we had nationwide turnout of about 60%. And of course, this varies by state. So some states may have had higher and some lower, but overall, it was about 60% turnout. And I'll add, although you didn't ask it yet, in 2018, the turnout nationwide in the midterms was about 50%. And that was a record from decades. And people were kind of celebrating, saying this is great civic engagement to have 50% turnout. You know, I thought that half the people didn't show up. What are we celebrating? It says something about a democracy when we're happy about the fact that half the eligible electorate didn't vote.
You know, that's amazing when you stop and think about it from that standpoint. And when you look at this, and, you know, part of your work involves looking at things like this in detail, what's really behind the numbers that we're seeing?
You know, I think there's a couple of factors, and it's a complex question to determine, you know, why is turnout so low compared to other countries or just in general. I think there's a couple of things we could point to. One are structural barriers to the ballot box. And when I say structural barriers, I mean things that make it just harder to vote, or the fact that it's not particularly easy or convenient in many places to participate in our democracy. So whether it's, you know, short polling hours or not very many early voting opportunities, voter ID issues, this, you know, sort of thing, or registration hurdles. You know, many states, if you're not registered by 30 days before election day, you're simply cut out of the process. So, you know, this package of election rules. And then the other thing is voter apathy. You know, many people feel like their vote won't make a difference. Why bother showing up? You know, if you're a Republican in California or a Democrat in Texas, you feel like in the presidential election, the outcome is predetermined. We can also point to things like redistricting, bad gerrymandering, campaign finance issues with big money seeming to dictate the outcomes. And people have this sense that, you know, why even bother?
But yet you can look at a case that you're familiar with, 2013 Ben Miller's case. Right, would you tell our audience about that?
Yeah. So Ben Miller was 16 years old in 2013, and he voted. How is this possible? Well, Tacoma Park, Maryland, lowered the voting age in 2013 to 16 for local elections. When I first heard about this reform, I thought it was kind of radical, actually. I didn't know much about it. And I've since become a proponent after learning about all of the various merits that are inherent in lowering the voting age, at least for local elections. So Tacoma Park did it first, and then it spread to places like Hydesville, Maryland, and Greenbelt, Maryland, hopped over the, across the country in Berkeley, California, lowered its voting age to 16 for school board elections. And actually, I just saw recently that the Los Angeles School Board unanimously voted to have a feasibility study about lowering the voting age to 16 for its school board elections. So this is something that is now starting to spread, and we can get into the details if you want. But, you know, Ben Miller was one of the first people to actually vote in American elections at the age of 16 because his city lowered the voting age.
So what do you say when people will say, and I'm sure you've heard this argument, that high school students aren't going to be mature enough to vote?
Well, that's a common reaction. And so I've done some research into psychological studies of brain development. And what I learned was that psychologists essentially break cognition into two categories. This is sort of simplified, but they essentially say that there's a difference between what they refer to as hot cognition and cold cognition. And hot cognition are sort of rapid decision-making, peer pressure issues, heat of the moment. And psychologists say that brains are not fully developed for proper hot cognition activities until at least age 21 and maybe 24 or 25. Cold cognition, on the other hand, is reasoned decision-making, not heat of the moment, not peer pressure right when the decision is happening. And psychologists say that brains are cognitively developed for cold cognition by age 16. So if we want to peg the voting age to where people are actually mature enough to make the kinds of decisions that are necessary for the election process, actually 16 makes a lot more sense.
So if young adults are allowed to cast their first vote when they're 16, are they more likely to vote?
Yeah, you know, studies show that one of the most indicative factors of whether someone's going to vote is whether they voted previously. So voting is habit forming. And studies show also that if you miss the first election from when you're eligible, then you're much less likely to become a habitual voter. You know, non-voting is habit forming as well. And 18 is kind of a strange time to start the voting process because, you know, people are moving away from their homes. They're either entering the workforce or going to school. They have to, in many places, register ahead of time, then request an absentee ballot, receive it, fill it out properly, sometimes get it witnessed properly, depending on the state, mail it back in time. There's a lot of hurdles to jump over to vote when you have all these other changes happening in your life. 16, however, makes a lot more sense because you're in the supportive environment of home and school. You know, we know where they all are, essentially, so we can get them registered. We can get them better educated in civics in engagement. And so I have a whole chapter about civics engagement and the ways in which we can reform that. I think that's an important part of this. And what's most interesting is that the places that have done this have proven results. So Tacoma Park, in 16 and 17-year-olds voted about twice the rate of 18 to 24-year-olds in those elections since 2013.
Well, what about this idea of actually lowering the voting age officially? I mean, last time it was lowered was, and this is a long time ago, 1972, when we went from 21 to 18. What's it going to take, or could it take, for us to lower the age again?
Yeah, so let me first say that, you know, it was 21, as you noted, for most of our history, but that is almost actually a historical accident. When our country was founded, we used essentially British common law that set the voting age at 21, and that comes from medieval practice, where 21 was the age in which men were thought to be able to wear a suit of armor, and so therefore were thought to sort of be part of society enough to also vote. And that was comes from medieval times, that it was British common law, and then we adopted that. And as you noted, lowered the voting age in the early 1970s to 18, based on the Vietnam War and this notion of old enough to fight, old enough to vote. If we wanted to lower the voting age to 16 nationwide, a constitutional amendment could make that happen, and there actually is a proposal in Congress to do that. Congress could lower the voting age to 16 for federal elections, but honestly, I think the best way to do this is kind of this city-by-city push that is already happening. We've had campaigns in places like San Francisco, Washington, D.C. City Council has considered lowering the voting age. When we moved it from 21 to 18, that happened in several states first before the constitutional amendment. Georgia and Kentucky lowered the voting age to 18 well before it happened nationwide. And I think this kind of piecemeal approach in cities is actually the best way, because we can prove therefore that it works in some places, and then more places are likelier to take the reform as well.
Mm. One of the topics that comes up in discussions on the topic of voting, obviously now, and sometimes this is very hotly debated, is this whole discussion about felon disenfranchisement. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I first think about what the history of felon disenfranchisement is, and it really comes from Jim Crow era laws to disenfranchise African Americans. You know, most felon disenfranchisement laws are from the late 1800s and early 1900s, where the country essentially was trying to find a way to cut newly freed slaves and African Americans out of the political process. So it has a racist history, and it also has a racist effect to this day, where you look at felon disenfranchisement rates and it just disproportionately harms minority voters. I also wonder why there's ever been a link between committing a crime and participating in our democracy. If we think that the right to vote is the most fundamental aspect of being a citizen in this country, and yet even when we send people to jail, we don't strip them of their citizenship. So I don't think former felons or returning citizens should be disenfranchised. There's also currently a discussion about whether we should even allow people to vote from prison. You know, Maine and Vermont do that, and no one suggests that democracy there has fallen apart because currently incarcerated individuals have the ability to vote. The movement really right now is to at least enfranchise people once they completed their sentences, and I think that's a very good move, and I'm happy to see that movement continue.
Can you point to social benefits from that?
Well, sure. So I tell the story in the book. I opened the book with a guy named Wes Powell, mm-hmm. who helped to convince the Kentucky legislature to pass an expungement bill to allow some low-level felons to get an expungement of their records. You know, Kentucky is one of the worst states in the country for felons enfranchisement. It still disenfranchises felons for life. But at least some low-level felons can get an expungement of their records thanks to Wes Powell essentially telling his story to a Senate Judiciary Committee and changing the minds of some of the legislators. And in terms of social benefits, you know, he himself talked about how even though he completed his sentence and paid his debt back to society, and he had stolen a car radio from an auto salvage yard when he was 18. 25 years later, he said, you know, I've cleaned up my life, and I got a job, I got married, I have 5 kids. What more do you want me to do to feel like a full member of society? And, you know, he basically said, by being branded a felon for life and not being able to vote, I don't feel like I'm actually part of my democracy.
We're talking with Josh Douglas on our program, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this chat, he is a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law, and he is joining us on our program talking with us about some of the information contained in the book, Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. That title obviously gets people's attention. What's the reaction been to it?
Well, the Vote for Us part is interesting because people have noted kind of the double meaning of us and U.S. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, sort of purposeful to note that, you know, this is really about all of us and about all of the United States. And it's not a partisan-laden book. You know, some people have said, well, you know, all of the reforms you talk about are intended just to help one political party over the other. And my answer is no, this is about helping our democracy. And, you know, many of these reforms actually are bipartisan. I can point to states, you know, so-called red states that are passing some of these reforms, just like so-called blue states. And then, you know, the subtitle of How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, I think people see the positive nature of that message. And, you know, this really is a positive book. It's about what's possible. So there's so much doom and gloom out there when it comes to the right to vote and this sense that voter suppression is on the rise and it's hard to participate in our elections. You know, that's true in many respects, and we need to fight back against that voter suppression, and we need to fight back against that doom and gloom. But the message here is that we can go beyond that to promote positive voting rights reforms thanks to these everyday individuals that I profile in the book. I call them democracy champions, you know, people like Ben Miller, who got to vote for the first time in Tacoma Park, or Wes Powell, who helped to convince the Kentucky legislature. And so really, I hope people see the optimism in the title and in the stories that are in the book about what's possible for our democracy.
The difference between voter registration fraud and election fraud. Would you talk about that?
Yeah. So many people feel like there's a lot of voter fraud in our system because they hear these notions that our voter registration rules are bloated, that they're outdated, that there's lots of people on the rolls who have moved away or who have died. And the simple answer is that voter registration bloat is not the same as election fraud. There simply is not a lot of election fraud in our system, and where there is, we find it. You know, you can point to the North Carolina example from 2018 in the congressional election there. Simply having outdated voter rolls doesn't mean that we have lots of people voting fraudulently. And, you know, this makes sense because people do move, people do die, and, you know, it's worth to update the registration rolls. But simply the fact of having registration rolls that are not 100% accurate in no way means that these people are actually voting fraudulently as well. And I think our conversation really does need to separate the two, you know, and even if people are found to engage in, you know, filling out voter registration forms fraudulently, that has nothing to do with whether these people are also engaged in actually trying to change election outcomes.
Well, do we have any real reason to fear this idea of trying to make it easier for people to vote? I mean, this is talked about an awful lot of, you know, making things easier, using technology, things like that.
Well, the only things we have to fear in terms of election fraud or security are systematic attempts to change results, you know, things like the security of election machines itself, foreign interference with our elections, you know, those sorts of things. It could have a difference if they occur because they're on large scale. And I contrast this with, for example, the common justification for strict photo identification laws, you know, where people say, well, you know, you need to be able to prove your identity before you vote because otherwise you might have all these fraudulent voters showing up and pretending to be someone they're not. And I look at the studies, you know, the only way to, the only thing, rather, that voter ID laws prevent is in-person impersonation, someone showing up to the polls and pretending they're someone they're not. And this just doesn't happen very much at all. And it'd be a really dumb way to throw an election. Because if you're trying to change election outcomes by getting a bunch of people to show up at the polls, well, you need a lot of people involved in the conspiracy to make sure you can make a difference. And the more people you involve, the more likely you are to be caught. So, you know, if people are trying to throw an election through in-person impersonation, it's just not a very smart way to do it. You know, we do need to be vigilant about the security of our elections, but that has to go with, you know, making sure our poll workers are being honest, making sure we're rooting out vote buying, absentee balloting. We've had issues there sometimes, but not on making it easier to vote in general.
This idea of trying to make voting as easy as possible and, you know, to make it attractive, you know, everything from people have talked about the idea of being able to vote online. Some people talk about trying to advocate the idea of making this as easy as food shopping. Is that realistic?
Yeah, well, the online part, maybe not yet. You know, there are some places that are experimenting with blockchain as a technological basis for online voting. And actually, some counties in West Virginia did use an app that involved blockchain for some overseas voters. And apparently it worked pretty well. But I'm not sure that the technology is there just yet for online voting through blockchain or some other means. But making voting as easy as food shopping, you know, actually is possible. And that gets the title of one of the chapters in one of the reforms that is known as vote centers. So this comes from Colorado, and the idea was started by a guy named Scott Doyle, a Republican engineer in Larimer County, Colorado, who joined the county clerk's office there late in his career. And he heard about some voters in 2000, during the presidential election in 2000, who were turned away from their polls. They had gone to what ended up being the wrong polling place, their wrong precinct, towards the end of the day and were turned away, and then went to what their correct polling place was, but they were too late. The polls had closed, and so they were disenfranchised because they made the mistake of going to the wrong place. And so Scott Doyle went home one night and sort of thought about, well, how do we vote, and does this really make sense? And again, he's kind of an engineer, so he brought his engineering expertise to the problem and sketched out models of voting and came up with a system known as vote centers, where essentially, instead of having to go to a home-based precinct, you know, the polling place closest to your house, you can go to any vote center in the county and vote. And you check in at the vote center there, and they're all electronically linked, so once you check into one, you can't go to the others. And it prints out the ballot for your home address. But this is kind of like food shopping in that, you know, as he put it, I can go to a supermarket anywhere I find one and get basically the same thing. Why can't voting be the same way? Why are we tied to our home-based precinct? And instead, you know, why can't I just go to the closest vote center to my work or to my school or if I'm out doing errands or whatever? So we got this implemented in Larimer County, and the voters loved it. Turnout went up. It was actually cheaper because they needed fewer polling stations and fewer poll workers. This has now spread to a handful of other places, including all of Colorado, which actually uses a dual system. They use universal vote by mail, where every voter is mailed about and vote centers. Places in New Mexico. Houston just announced it's going to move the vote center model. Kansas said that it'll allow its counties to use vote centers. Indiana, so a bunch of places use this now to great success.
Mm. What about the impact of the voting by mail?
Yeah, so, you know, this started in Oregon initially, thanks to the innovative thinking of a guy there named Phil Kiesling. And interestingly, Phil, who, when he was in the Oregon legislature, was opposed to universal vote by mail, also known as vote at home, because he had this notion of the civic-minded nature of joining your neighbors to feel the crunch of the leaves in the autumn as you walk to your polling place. But as he put it, you know, I was mistaking the essence of voting with, or the practice of voting with its essence, which is participation. And universal vote by mail or vote at home increases participation because it makes it so much easier for people to participate from the comforts of their home. So the way it works is that the state or the county automatically mails you your ballot about 2 or 3 weeks before election day. So you can sit at home and research the issues and candidates. This leads to a more informed, educated electorate. And then drop off your ballot at a secure drop box or mail it in through the mail. It began in a few counties in Oregon first, and then it spread statewide. Now it's the reality for all elections in Washington, as well as Colorado, which I noted uses kind of this dual system where everyone receives a ballot, and then, but if you don't, for whatever reason, return it, you can go to any vote center on election day. Almost all of Utah uses universal vote by mail, all but one county. Hawaii just passed a law to allow universal vote by mail. But here's the most important part. Turnout in these states is much higher than in states that use the traditional system of, you know, in-person polling places with, you know, the ability to request an absentee ballot. Some states require you still to have an excuse. And the studies show that turnout is just much higher in universal vote-by-mail states as compared to the other states.
More with you, Josh, as we continue. We're talking with Josh Douglas. He's a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law. His book is entitled Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. He's talking with us on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. The Electoral College, Josh, is this really needed?
No. You know, maybe it once was, or we could at least debate that in terms of the different nature of our country. But today we have, you know, nationwide campaigns, nationwide communication in a much different society. And this isn't about election results. It's about democracy, and it's about increasing participation. You know, as I said, there are people in some states who just don't feel like it even matters whether they vote in their state's presidential election because the outcome seems preordained. And the candidates just focus on, you know, the 6 to 8 swing states to the exclusion of the rest of the country. Now, this is a difficult thing to change because it's in the Constitution, so you need a constitutional amendment or a workaround. And there's currently a system that is trying to be adopted called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, where essentially states agree to award their electoral votes not to whoever wins their state, but to whoever wins the national popular vote. And it's passed in about a dozen states. It doesn't go into effect, however, until enough states have passed it to equal 270, which is the number of electoral college votes that are needed to win. I think there's also some serious constitutional questions if it ever does pass enough states. I mean, it is basically a workaround to the Constitution. So, you know, it's a difficult problem, but unfortunately it's one that is kind of embedded within our current Constitution.
Other countries, in some cases, get higher voter participation rates than we do here. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with us?
Yeah, what's wrong with that picture, in other words?
Well, you know, we consider ourselves an advanced democracy, the envy of the world, and yet we fall pretty low on the ranking scale when it comes to our voter participation. You know, some countries have mandatory voting, where it's essentially a requirement, and they have turnout of 90-95%. Australia does this, and they have a pretty educated electorate. I'm not suggesting that we adopt mandatory voting here, but I do think that if we adopt all of the reforms I talk about, we could achieve something close to, you know, very high turnout. In the book, I say, why not strive for, you know, 90% turnout, which seems crazy given our current numbers, but, you know, why not have a goal like that? And then, you know, if we only reach 77 or 75%, well, that's pretty darn good. It's a pretty good improvement. But, you know, what's wrong is, again, we make it not easy to vote in many places. There's a lot of voter apathy. And the combination of those leads to, in my view, a less engaged electorate than we should have for a democracy that should be the envy of the world.
Mm. Now, one of the things that's interesting at the end of your book, you actually put forth an idea of Vote for Us, the musical, and invite the creator of Hamilton to collaborate with you. Where'd you get that idea?
Well, I'm a Hamilton junkie, so I'm a little bit of addicted to the musical. You know, it's done such great things to engage the citizenry in our history, particularly young people. You know, you see these high school students doing projects involving Hamilton. There's been a big revival. And the book is really about engaging the electorate. As I mentioned, I have a whole chapter on civics education. And, you know, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, you know, if Lynn is listening and would be interested in collaborating, I mean, I think that would be great. But really the underlying message here, and I think this hopefully goes to the whole message of the book, is that it's everyday Americans who are doing this great work already to implement many of these changes for their either local or state elections, and their stories are so compelling. You know, I interviewed over 50 people for this book, these everyday Americans that I call democracy champions, and I was so inspired by them. Every time I got off an interview, I rushed to my computer to keep writing, to try to tell their stories. And, you know, Hamilton the Musical is really a story, a really compelling story about these amazing, flawed, but incredible everyday Americans who started a revolution and created our country. And today's democracy champions, I think, are linked to the democracy champions of Hamilton's time through advocacy involving stories and storytelling. And so I think the stories in the book are actually something that would be good fodder for a musical because of the inspiring nature of them.
Final question for you. Some people might have thought I might have asked this early on in the discussion. For those who read this book, what are you hoping they take away from it?
Well, I hope they're inspired. I hope they understand what is possible for our democracy. You know, too much of our discussion as we began, Bob, is about doom and gloom. And people seem to kind of throw up their hands and you know, feel like they won't be able to change anything. Someone noted a term to me recently called slacktivism, where, you know, you might say rah-rah, or, you know, we don't like this, but, you know, really do anything to make actual change. And so I hope people reading the book feel that there is some optimism about what change is possible. But beyond the hope, beyond the inspiration, I also want people to actually take action. And that's why I included a fairly lengthy appendix that has a list of all 50 states and organizations in each one. There's about 3 or 4 organizations for every state that are working on issues of democracy reform. So I hope people read the book, but then also flip to the back and wherever they are and find an organization and contact and say, okay, I can help. I can also be a democracy champion. I can spend an hour a week making our elections process easier, more convenient, more inclusive, more democratic, because that, I think, is what's going to ultimately help to improve our system.
Most interesting discussion with Josh Douglas. He's a professor at the University of Kentucky College of Law and the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Thank you very much for joining us. Certainly the best with your work.
Thanks, Bob. This was fun.
Joined by Rich Castle on our program. Rich is a native New Yorker, senior vice president for Gladstein, Neen Dross and Associates, and E2 New York chapter director. He is talking with us on our program. We're going to get into a couple of interesting areas of discussion because we're going to talk about the topic of clean energy and employment. Now, those are interesting areas of discussion. First of all, Rich, it's nice to have you join us on our program. Good morning.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Bob.
I guess let's do a little bit of background. First of all, would you tell us a little bit about the firm that I mentioned?
Sure. So Environmental Entrepreneurs, or E2 for short, is a national organization of business leaders who work to advance policies that will be good for the environment and good for the economy. We're looking for win-wins. And, you know, renewable power, which we'll talk about, is really exactly that kind of win-win that we look for and that we look to advance in New York. Programs that are going to reduce emissions and reduce costs for consumers and businesses. E2 is a national organization, but we have chapters, and I co-direct the New York chapter. And your listeners can learn more at e2.org, where there's a lot of information about the work we do.
When we talk about that idea of renewable power and trying to advance this in New York, how receptive an environment do you find?
Well, New York is rapidly becoming a real leader in the nation and, frankly, around the world on clean energy and renewable power. Governor Cuomo announced the Clean Energy Standard, which firmly puts New York on the path to cleaner renewable energy. And by renewable energy, I mean solar, wind, hydropower, zero-emission energy sources. By 2030, under this program, at least half of all of the energy we use in New York State will be renewable. We're going to see dramatic increases in solar and wind, and we're going to see dramatic increases in the jobs that are associated with the transition away from fossil fuels over towards clean energy.
When you say dramatic, I guess I always want to know, can we quantify that?
Well, we can, actually. E2 released a report with a number of other organizations this summer that found that New York already has 85,000 clean energy jobs. These are jobs in every county in the state, although more than 50,000 of them are here in New York City, where I live and work. And when we say clean energy jobs, we mean everything from companies that are building solar panels in Buffalo or wind farms in Ithaca to firms that are retrofitting apartment buildings in the city from burning dirty, high-sulfur heating oil in the winter to cleaner, more efficient natural gas. Companies that are working in every town, every county in the state to retrofit homes and offices with energy-efficient lighting and windows and air conditioning and other appliances. So we're talking about a lot of different types of jobs, and we're going to see growth because as we transition over, right now we're just under a quarter renewable power. Most of that is hydropower. As we transition towards at least half of it and much more solar and wind and energy efficiency in our homes and offices, we're going to see those jobs take off. 85,000 is the number today. That's roughly comparable to the construction industry in New York. We're going to see that go up dramatically.
How will that impact things like areas like transportation, because, you know, you think of the whole movement toward electric vehicles and the like.
Well, I think we're going to see big changes in the types of cars we drive, and we're also going to see big changes in how we drive. We already have hybrids, of course. We're starting to see more and more plug-in hybrid cars, cars that can run on gasoline or electric power, and you can plug them in at night if you and we're starting to see more and more electric vehicles, and those range from battery electric cars, fully electric on battery, to even the start of some cars that run on hydrogen fuel cells. Toyota is going to start soon selling a car like that in New York. So, you know, we're really starting to see a change in the technologies. And even for just the plain old-fashioned gasoline car, the fuel economy of that car will double by 2025 under a program that was adopted by the Obama administration a couple of years ago. So we're really going to see a big change. It's very exciting, and I think it'll have environmental benefits, but it'll also have economic benefits because we won't be paying so much for gasoline anymore.
And is this something which we, you know, are going to really be able to see and feel the state touting as it markets itself? Because, you know, New York State does an aggressive job also of trying to market to businesses and obviously to individuals about relocating here.
Right. I think that the combination of clean, renewable electricity and a much more efficient transportation system here is a good combination for businesses that are looking for places to locate, especially here in the city. You know, New York City released a report last month that found that by 2050, 80% of the trips that people take, getting to work, delivering packages, are going to be by some clean source. You know, we're seeing it. We already have the best transit system in the country, but we're going to see more and more shared vehicles like the Ubers, and we're going to see all sorts of ideas that are just starting to come out in ways that we can get around cleaner. And then you add in replacing coal and natural gas, old natural gas plants, with the newest, most efficient gas plants, solar, wind, hydro. The electricity portfolio is going to be safe, it's going to be cost-effective, it's going to be reliable, And it's going to be good for business.
Rich, thank you very much for joining us and sharing these insights. This is a situation we're obviously going to be watching because it's one that's going to affect and hopefully benefit all of us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to speak with you and your listeners today.
I'm Bob Salter. We're joined by Ashley Papa. Ashley is a Fox News Magazine contributor, a relationship reporter. She covers it all, sex, love, dating, marriage, and more. And we're going to get into some interesting areas of discussion. Nice to have you join us on our program, first of all, Ashley.
Thank you so much.
In beginning this discussion, here's an area that affects a lot of people who are listening to our discussion right now. The idea of texting and the habits that they have while texting. Can that affect one's love life and affect it in a negative fashion?
Yes, definitely. Somebody's texting habits can be a real turnoff to some others. There's several ways that it can. For instance, if you're a person who loves to text and the person that you're in a relationship with or just starting to date hates texting, then right off the bat, you're turning them off. And other things that turn people off could be their style, whether they write really short and it looks like they're not interested, or if they write really long and it's almost like you have to scroll through their text to see to get what they're saying. And those kind of text messages you should be saving for a real person-to-person conversation or over the phone. So sometimes people just get overwhelmed by the length of the text and what is said on the text message.
What about, because this is one of the things that drives me crazy with texts, are the amount of grammar mistakes that there are in typical texts, you know, whether it's misspellings or just the wrong use of words. Is that something that rubs people the wrong way?
Yeah, it's definitely a turnoff to many. There was a study done by Match.com recently that said men and women, it revealed men and women's top texting turnoffs, and one of them was bad grammar. And people can get lazy on text and they don't care, or they don't care about the difference between there and there. But to somebody who you're texting, it can make you look dumb to that person if texting is, or if grammar is a big deal for them. For me, it would be a big deal because I'm a writer. So if somebody's using improper language, then I would, you know, it'd be a turnoff for me. Or it's laziness as well if they're shortening words. And yeah, it's another reason why you could be sabotaging your love life.
How about the one-word answer people?
Yeah, well, that's very frustrating to many as well if they just respond with a K or hey. A lot of times they can have hidden meanings, or you think they have hidden meanings, so it drives you crazy trying to think, like, why are they only texting me one word? Are they mad at me? What do they mean by this? It's vague. But on the other hand, it could be just because the person doesn't like to text long responses. You never really know what you're getting from a text message.
And, of course, the classic, when somebody texts you and it's all caps.
Right, because usually caps indicate that they're yelling at you. So that's another huge turnoff. So you don't want to have your caps on. Sometimes, you know, phones are finicky. The caps lock and you don't know how to turn it off and you end up texting an all caps message. So another reason why people are turned off by text messaging styles.
What about the idea of getting a text from somebody that, you know, you're dating while you're at work?
Yeah, that can be annoying to some. I know that Match also said that men don't like it when they're texted from somebody they're dating at work. Women, on the other hand, may enjoy it. Some people like to get those random texts during the day because then it shows, oh, they're thinking about me. And then some just don't like it. So you don't really know. You have to have that conversation with the person you're dating. Should I text you during the day or do you not like it? If the person doesn't get a response right away during the day, then the person who sent the text message may think that they're being ignored when the other person could just be extremely busy. Then later in the day, there could be some animosity because there wasn't a quick response with the text message, and it just creates just a lot of unnecessary angst among a couple.
Mm. And then we get into that really tricky area where, you know, you're texting somebody that you used to be in a relationship with. How big a no-no is that?
It's a huge no-no because the relationship ended, so therefore you shouldn't be reaching out to one another. But it's so easy and it's so tempting to just send that hey text to see if they'll respond. You know, back in the day when we didn't have texting, even really cell phones, well, before texting came out, you couldn't reach out to somebody that easily. And now it just takes a lot more willpower and strength to not reach out to somebody you shouldn't be texting.
Mm. Mm. And then if you get one of those texts from an ex, should you just ignore it?
You know, it's your call. You can ignore it if you don't feel the need to communicate with this person, or you respond or you call them and tell them not to text you, or you have a conversation in person. You know, the text should be used to set up a meeting if you need to talk to somebody, not do it over text. So it's really up to the person and if they want to respond or not. And that's another issue with texting. It's a power play. Somebody can just keep ignoring the person, and the other person who sent the text, it just drives them crazy because they're not getting a response. And then all these thoughts come into their heads.
The idea in a dating situation of when should somebody call versus when they should text.
Yeah, well, when a text message is more of a conversation, if it's going on for hours, or you have to actually scroll through a message to read what they're saying, that's when it should be on the phone or in person. The text messages should be used for little things, to confirm a date, just to say hi, or just to maybe message whatever reason you feel like saying hi or anything. But it shouldn't be used for anything serious or anything too in-depth.
What about sending pictures?
Well, pictures are fine, depending on, you know, what the couple likes. If they just want to send a picture of what they're doing, that's fine. Make sure that it's that both people feel it's, you know, pictures are appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
If one person doesn't want, like, a sextic picture, then you shouldn't automatically think that everyone likes to get those kind of pictures, because some people don't.
Mm. We're talking with Ashley Papa on our program. She's a Fox News Magazine contributor, a relationship reporter. She covers it all. By the way, sounds like you have a lot of fun with what you do.
I do. I try and, because I have a journalism background, I like to do interviews. I like to interview people just like me who are in the real world dating. I like to interview people who are more who are older and married, and maybe experts in their field, like therapists or psychologists, and get their take on stuff as well. And I like to follow all the dating trends. There's all the new apps that are coming out. I like to look at new studies that come out as well, and just try to keep up with the times when it comes to dating. So there's just people like reading about that stuff.
What about,
I like to make it entertaining.
What about those new dating apps, Ashley?
Well, you know what I've been finding recently is, so there's a lot out there. I believe that there's over 2,000 in the world. The last time I had my research department find the exact number for me, that's a lot. And they're pretty much for any kind of interest as well. You can find a dating website for people that are just into motorcycles. You can find online dating websites for specific races and ethnicities. But one thing I've noticed recently with some of these up-and-coming apps is a lot of them seem to focus more on getting a conversation started or meeting in person first. There's this new app called Willow. It's not a dating app, but because it brands itself as a conversation app, like you start talking about a specific topic, and then a date usually can come out of it, and that's the bonus. And then another app that's out there is, it's all about trying to find a right bar or restaurant that has the scene that you want. People check in, and it shows you on the app who is at this bar. So you can kind of pinpoint a bar, depending on who was there, who you want to meet, and interest. So it actually gets you out away from the computer or your phone to meet people in person. So it's kind of trying to get these new apps developed by these younger guys actually are more about the in-person and conversation, which I find interesting.
Imagine that trend actually happening, huh?
I know.
You actually meet people in person, huh?
I know. I don't know if it'll do well. It seems like people like to hide that, you know, passive aggressiveness, hiding behind their phone. So,
what about the world of the people who are divorced, whether it's recently divorced or they've been divorced for some time and they're getting back into, or they are actively in the dating world?
Well, there's definitely online dating websites for that as well. And a lot of people who are newly divorced and back out on the scene seem to go that route because, you know, maybe going out in public or meet at bars is something kind of foreign to them if they've been married for so long. So a lot of the experts would advise starting out, maybe seeing a matchmaker or going to an online dating site. And there's specific sites for that, whether you're just divorced or you're divorced and you have kids. There's like Single Parent Meet, some one of them is popular. So all tons of options for you.
Ashley, what about, because we'll shift in discussion into another area that you've looked at, which is the idea for, a lot of us have pets, whether it's, you know, dog or cat, or you have both, or you have multiples of either. What does that say about that person when it comes to their approach to romance?
Well, there's specific personality traits that match with whether you are a cat or a dog lover. And there was a recent study that showed just how that is. It was the University of Texas and found that dog people are 15% more extroverted and 13% more agreeable than cat people. Cat people are more neurotic, but they're more open. So dog lovers tend to be more of the tender. They may be a little bit more needy. They're more playful, whereas a cat lover might be a little bit more independent, more likely to make the decisions in the relationship, and they only like to do things on their time when they say so. And the dog people are a little bit more, like I said, needy, because a dog needs a lot more attention than a cat does. It kind of can be said for a dog and cat lovers. So that's what the experts say. And when it comes to sex as well, they say that the cat lovers are a little bit more adventurous. And then they say that for people who have multiple of a pet, that shows that they're more interested in their pets than they are in the relationship. So you might be a little bit, watch out for somebody like that. But that doesn't mean that you can't try and date them, of course. It could be, you know, maybe rescuing dogs, which is a good thing.
They're more interested in their pets than in the relationship if they have multiples.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
It's just a lot. It's a lot to take care of. But maybe they just are that, they just like taking care of people and animals. So, yeah.
Fun approach that you take with your work. Ashley Papa, who is a Fox News Magazine contributor, relationship reporter. She has a website at AshleyPapa, that's all as one word, .com. Thanks so much for sharing a few things with us in our discussion here on our program. It's nice to have you join us on our program. Certainly good luck with your work.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Well, Anne Liguori is going to continue the fun after 7 this morning. Rick Wolf has the Sports Edge program along at 8 o'clock. And Mike Francesa is by at 9 o'clock. We will see you bright and early at 6 next Sunday morning here on The Fan.
At Lowe's, we're about to kick off something epic for fans who want more messy. And trust us, you'll want to be a rewards member when it happens. Join for free and get access to messy exclusives, surprises, and more.
Head to Lowe's.com/moremessy. Now's the time to get in, because members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Would you look at that? It's time for some of our favorite Snapple Real Facts. Real Fact 1433, toe wrestling is a competitive sport. Real Fact 732, the chicken is the closest living relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. And Real Fact 1599, a man once ate an entire airplane. Youch, did he have any hot sauce? Yeah, so anyways, this has been a refreshing break brought to you by Snapple. Real tea, real juice.
With Snap's Identity Refreshing!
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Lemonade! Fresh squeeze lemonade! Lemonade? Oh, nuts.
Is your business struggling to be seen? Not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, mine starts here.